Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Intent to Induce Infringement and Patent Misuse Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 31, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument for two cases, Commel USA v. Cisco Systems and Kimball v. Marvel Enterprises. In Commel, the question is whether a defendant's good faith belief that a patent is invalid is a defense against a claim of induced patent infringement. In Kimball, the issue concerns whether the court should overturn a long-standing precedent under which a patent holder cannot obtain royalty payments beyond the expiration of the patent. To discuss these cases, we have Professor Gregory Dolan, Associate Professor of Law and Co-Director of the Center for Medicine and Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Dolan.
Thank you so much, and thanks again for having me here. It's always a pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity both to attend the oral argument and to share my views on it. As I suppose the appropriate disclaimer, the views are just my own and simply based on the impression that I got listening to the cases. So it's always a fool's errand to predict how the courts are going to roll, but I will nonetheless try to do that. If maybe not predict, then at least sort of give some information as to what transpired. So I'll begin with the first case and then sort of talk a little bit about that, and then I'll move to the second case. So the first case was Commel, and the basic issue in that case was what is a legitimate defense for a person accused not of direct infringement but of induced infringement. So basically what transpired is Cisco Systems was accused of selling equipment that was being then used by its customers to infringe Commel's patent. So Cisco was not itself infringing, but it was accused of helping others, i.e. inducing others to infringe. And that's in a world of patent law is known as inducement. In order to win the case of inducement, Commel had to show that it had a valid patent and that Cisco committed certain acts that would in fact induce. However, Cisco argued that it's not enough that Commel showed that Cisco argued that it should prevail even if ultimately the patent was held to be valid and ultimately infringed. It would be good enough to escape liability if Cisco could prove to the court that it had, before trial, had a good faith belief that the patent was invalid. So even if ultimately that belief ended up being erroneous, Cisco, under its theory, would prevail because it had a good faith belief because it didn't have sort of that bad mens rea. Now, this argument would not have worked if Cisco was accused of direct infringement because infringement is a strict liability offense. But induced infringement is potentially different because it does have the sort of this knowledge requirement. And a few terms ago, Supreme Court decided a case called Global Tech where they did say that knowledge of infringing activity is necessary. So basically the Commel case was the question was, does knowledge of validity of the patent, is that also necessary? Out of the gate, I think petitioners had, at least initially for a while, had a tougher time arguing. Out of the gate, Justice Kennedy asked, why shouldn't the accused have to prove a good faith belief to get out of the liability? Followed very quickly by Justice Roberts asking, pointing out that a large percentage of patents are indeed invalid. And sort of the response to his question was that about 40% of adjudicated patents are invalid. As a sort of caveat, I'm not sure if that's exactly the right number because there's a difference between invalid patent and invalid claim. So, for example, if 5 or 6 claims of the same patents are being litigated, only one of them is found invalid, it depends really how you count. So the accused infringer might still be liable even though 1 of 5 might be invalid. But anyway, so that large number of 40% certainly raised some eyebrows. The idea was that, look, if 40% of patents are invalid and you're accused inducer and you're going into litigation thinking, well, basically it's a 50-50 chance that I'm infringing a valid or invalid patent, such good faith belief should be enough to get out of liability. The justice who sort of went down the road got a bit of a pushback from the petitioner, basically arguing that, look, it cannot be that the accused inducer is in a world where heads I win and tails I win too. because what an accused inducer was trying to do, according to the petitioners, was that they would win if the patent is indeed invalid, but they would also win if the patent is valid and they just made a wrong bet. The biggest skepticism I think petitioners encountered was from Justice Scalia, who said that the concept of inducements or this entire theory stems from the old common law of aiding and abetting, and in common law, aiding and abetting did in fact require scienter. And so Justice Scalia sort of kept pushing on that both during the petitioner's argument and during the government's argument in support of the petitioner as amicus. Justice Kagan also brought up an important issue, which is familiar to anybody who's ever litigated a patent case or followed any patent litigation, said, isn't invalidity and non-infringement, aren't they simply oftentimes two sides of the same coin? So the example that she gave, suppose that you are a company that potentially might be infringing somebody's patent or a patent is brought to your attention, and your legal opinion after reviewing the patent is that, look, if it's constructed narrowly, I don't infringe. But if it's constructed broadly, I do infringe, but it's also invalid. And so in light of global tech, the first set of beliefs would be a defense, as long as it's good faith. And so she said, why shouldn't the second set of beliefs, why shouldn't that be good faith? And from my perspective, I think the response to her was not particularly edifying from the petitioners. I think there could have been a better way to respond to it, but I think the point that the petitioners tried to impress on Justice Kagan and the rest of the court is that it should be different because Congress created a presumption of validity, which of course then caused Justice Kagan to circle right back to Justice Roberts' question about, you know, well, if there's this presumption of validity, why, you know, then why 40% of the patent held invalid? So perhaps there's something to that. After that, the government got to argue. The government sort of ran into trouble pretty quickly because I think the government at least attempted to convince the court that that the case that I mentioned before, Global Tech, did not decide what the court thought it decided. So the government spent a fair amount of time going back and forth with justices over their understanding not of the present case, but of Global Tech. But at the end of the day, when the government finally got the chance to talk about this argument, I think they got across the point that they got across sort of two points. That one, in response to Justice Scalia's pointing out that inducement is just not a very important doctrine at all because you can always go after direct infringement. Government pointed out that that's not always true. For example, Congress has given exceptions to, say, physicians who performed surgeries against any charge of infringement, but you can still go after manufacturers of scalpels or other machinery. So the government did impress on the court that inducement is not just some sort of supplemental backwater type of legal theory, but in fact something that's oftentimes the primary way to enforce your patent. And the second thing that I think the government managed to get across quite well once it sort of got out of this whole global tech technology is that ultimately the burdens are different. So it is true that it's the burden of the patentee to prove that the patent is indeed infringed, but it's the burden of the infringer to prove to the extent he wants to that the patent is invalid. And that difference in burdens should sway the court in government's view to not extend global tech beyond what it actually said. So it should not allow the mere good faith belief in invalidity to invoke good faith belief in invalidity to simply evade liability. The defense argument was presented by Seth Waxman. For a while, I thought for the first maybe 5 or 7 minutes, I thought that he would have a very easy time of it because for a while, nobody asked him pretty much any questions. And so he's had it just floor to himself for quite a while. But eventually, I think Justice Sotomayor and indeed Justice Kagan did start asking fairly pointed questions. Specifically, both Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan pointed out that unlike Justice Scalia's view that this is just mere aiding and abetting, that this is sort of different, that this is about actually actively inducing, making somebody infringe for you. And Justice Roberts ultimately joined in pressing Mr. Waxman by pointing out that if we treat patent as law, in no other area is mistake of law, even good faith mistake of law, is actually a defense. While mistake of fact might be a defense, mistake of law is not. And I think that's sort of important given the fact that infringement is a question of fact. You simply take the accused device and you compare it element by element as a factual matter to what is claimed in the patent. While invalidity oftentimes, although sometimes it's a question of fact, oftentimes it's simply a question of law. And so whether the patent is valid or invalid is a legal question. conclusion. And I think Justice Roberts picked up on that and said that if we treat patents as actual legal instruments, then mistake of law, even a good faith mistake of law, should not be a defense to a charge of either infringement or induced infringement. Justice Kagan said along the same lines that even if you treat patents as contracts, as not as a legal document, but as a, like a statute, but as actually a contractual document, so same argument would hold, that if you sort of decide to interfere with a contract or you decide not to perform under a contract, and it, because you think it's an unconscionable contract, then if you're right, you're right, but if you're wrong, then you would still be liable for damages. So about halfway through Seth Waxman's argument, I think he got some serious pushback about what he was saying, but I think several times Justice Scalia did come to his aid, again, pressing this point about common law. One sort of issue that Mr. Waxman kept harping on and sort of kept raising again and again, and unfortunately I don't think he got very good pushback either from justices or the petition on rebuttal, was a kind of a parade of horribles. He kept saying that if we lose, if the respondents lose, if the Federal Circuit is reversed, then every time we get a demand letter, and he said Cisco gets thousands of them every year, we would have to stop production, we would have to figure out whether we actually do or do not infringe, we'll have to go and litigate, and that might take a while. And, you know, and in the meantime, we will not be able to sell products to our customers or actually operate our business given how many of these demand letters we get. And unfortunately, I don't think that ever got any response, even though that I think response was fairly obvious that that parade of horribles is true whether you're being accused of direct or indirect infringement, and yet somehow we survive and so on companies do every time they get demand letters. Whether they're accused of direct infringement or indirect, they manage to do it, and then they don't always stop their production. So ultimately, I think the big question that Mr. Waxman left unresolved was the question of who should really bear the risk of being wrong. In his view, it was that the patentee should bear the risk of somebody else's good faith belief of patent invalidity. But I think several justices gave a pushback that was sort of picked up on rebuttal, and that was kind of the main rebuttal point that it's okay to make that gamble, but the question is who should bear the risk. And in the view of the petitioners, and the view, at least maybe not in the view, but in the question of some of the justices, they were also wondering why should that risk from this bad gamble be shifted to somebody who actually went ahead and got a patent. So kind of the bottom line of this case, I think if I had to weigh based on sort of the level of skepticism of the questions, I think petitioners had a somewhat tougher time, but I think by the end of the argument, it somewhat equalized in terms of equal amount of, if not equal, at least sufficient amount of skepticism of respondents' position as well. So on the second case is, interestingly enough, doesn't come from the Federal Circuit. It comes from the Ninth Circuit because it is sort of less of a patent, more of an antitrust case. And so second case is Kimball. And at issue of the second case was whether or not, once you license your patent, you can set your royalties to run not just during the terms of the patent, but afterwards. And so that's what happened in Kimball. After sort of initially suing Mattel Toys and going through various rounds of negotiations, Kimball and Mattel signed an agreement where Mattel would agree to pay Kimball a certain royalty percentage without time limit on a particular amount of toy, and on a particular type of toy. And that went on for a while, and everybody was happy with it until additional dispute arose, and ultimately Mattel sued to invalidate that provision. And under an obscure 1960s patent decision, and I say obscure because at the time that initial agreement between Kimball and Mattel was signed, neither party was aware of this decision's existence. But so under this obscure 1960s decision called Brulotti, Brulotte, I think that's the proper spell, the royalties that extend past the life of the patent are per se illegal, as being per se anti-competitive by keeping people from practicing the patent for free once patent expires. This decision has come under severe criticism from a variety of courts and commentators as making very little economic sense, because after all, once patent expires, even though somebody is paying you royalties, other people can certainly enter the market. And so the decision was viewed as somewhat anachronistically, including by the Ninth Circuit, but being an inferior court, they felt bound to invalidate this agreement as per governing binding Supreme Court precedent. The petitioners had, in this case, basically asked for Brulotte to be overruled as being a relic of an age when antitrust law and sort of patent law simply were not as steeped in economics, as traditional study of economics, as they are today. And I, ultimately, on the substantive point, petitioners got almost no pushback. The entire case ultimately, I think, revolved around the question of why should the court abandon their long-held view and consistently held view of statutory stare decisis. So why doesn't the Congress resolve it? We've had this for 50 years. There's no particular problem with this. And so, you know, a remedy could be sought in Congress. Almost no one except Justice Breyer actually gave any pushback on the substantive problem with the law. So the fact that the court got it wrong in 1960. Justice Breyer was the only one who thought, at least based on the questions, that there may be situations where these royalties, if the patent is licensed to a small number of people, but a particular industry only consists of a small number of people, where basically everybody is prevented from entering the market once patent expires, because everybody who's in the industry already is promised to pay royalties forever and ever. Justice Roberts pushed back on this, saying that, look, if you have to sell your products for a higher price, that's an open invitation for other people to enter the market. And so I think on the economics of it, most of the justices were with the petitioners. And most of the argument really was about the stare decisis aspect of it. But even to Justice Breyer's point that there may be situations where these agreements are problematic, the response that the petitioners gave, I thought, was fairly convincing. They said, look, we're not asking these agreements to be declared to be per se legal. We're simply asking for the old relic of the per se rules that exist almost nowhere in antitrust anymore to be abandoned. So they concede that there are very well may be situations that under rule of reason, a particular agreement in a particular industry with particular features may in fact run afoul of the rule of reason. But so they kept sort of responding to Justice Breyer that this is not about necessarily being legal, but about, you know, giving a chance to both parties to prove the legality of such agreements. After petitioners argued, respondents got up, and they had a sort of very hard time, because I think respondents wanted to talk about, again, mostly stare decisis and about reliance interests. And I don't think almost anybody was buying that anyone was relying on this old Brulati case, given the fact that even both petitioners responded in this very case that revolves around Brulati admitted in their briefs that they had no idea of this case's existence up until litigation began. So I don't think the justices were very much buying the argument of reliance interest that, you know, should make it more likely to uphold on the basis of stare decisis. I think the government ran into the same problems. Again, the government basically, for a while, got a chance to speak without being interrupted, but almost the entirety of the government's argument was on stare decisis and not basically on defending the decision on its own merits, although the government sort of tried to do it. They tried to say that Brulati was not really wrong, but I think they didn't really have a very strong go of it. So I think ultimately this case is going to come down on the, you know, I think petitioners are going to win, and the justices are going to be convinced that stare decisis in this case is just not, you know, statutory stare decisis is not, is outweighed by considerations of the decision simply being wrong and somewhat outdated. Justice Roberts suggested as much. He said that we've often overruled, just in the last few years, we've overruled a number of old antitrust doctrines because they were just simply outmoded and based on bad science. But again, there were sort of some justices who thought that just the comity to Congress and the idea that petitioners and other similar situated, for example, such as universities who filed an amicus brief in support of petitioners' position, that they could simply seek redress in Congress, who would then be able to better balance the various interests at stake. So, but ultimately, I think, again, so as I said in the beginning, this is going to be my last observation, that it's a fool's errand to predict how the court would rule. But ultimately, I think that given that almost no one, perhaps save for Justice Breyer, was buying the merits of the Brulati argument, I would guess that petitioners are more likely to prevail in this case than not.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.com. www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.